From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The annual College Board report on college costs and financial aid offers a little good news, suggesting the tuition increases have slowed compared to inflation, and there might be a little more student aid money available to students. And Brown University announces a new program to promote internship opportunities, which includes stipends for students on financial aid who take low or unpaid positions. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment today, we'll discuss college costs and student aid. Released this week, the annual reports from the College Board on tuition costs and trends in student aid offer modestly positive news. Although college costs, as reflected by tuition charges, continue to rise, the increases are smaller than in recent years and are more in line with inflation as compared to past years when costs rose well over inflation. Declining state support plays a major role in the tuition increases at public institutions, up 10% over inflation during the past 5 years for undergraduate programs, while for private nonprofit colleges, undergraduate tuition rose 13% beyond inflation during the same period. But even as the so-called retail costs have risen, the net price for students in some sectors has declined somewhat in recent years as the federal government has increased funding for Pell Grants. Net costs are down slightly for students at private nonprofit institutions and public two-year colleges, but are up for students in public four-year colleges. And given the public conversation about student loan debt, which at more than $1 trillion now surpasses consumer credit card debt, the good news in the College Board reports this year is that loan dollars as a percentage of undergraduate student aid packages are declining, if just slightly. Joining us to help make sense of all these numbers and all this data are Sandy Baum, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, professor of higher education at George Washington University, and the co-author of the College Board Trends Reports, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to you both. Sandy, let me turn to you first. These reports have massive amounts of data in terms of trends, numbers, dollars, percentages, inflation adjustments. What's the top-level message if I'm a college president, if I'm a financial aid officer, if I'm a civilian, or if I'm a member of Congress trying to understand what's going on here?
There are a lot of numbers, and we don't expect anybody to see all of them or process all of them at one time, but we hope they are a valuable reference. But I think that the message that really comes through this year is that we should be more careful about looking at 1 or 2 year changes and predicting that the trends will continue at exactly the same rate. So during the recession, as always, tuition rose faster than usual, and student borrowing also rose at a very rapid rate. And now that the economy is recovering somewhat, all of these trends are, if not reversing, at least quieting down. And so we can step back and look at the long run.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, you're on the receiving end of this. You're one of the folks that helped filter it for the rest of us. What's your take in terms of what's the top-level message from these reports?
Well, I mean, I would agree with the theme that Sandy outlined, that things are sort of calming down. And yet, I think looking at what's going on right now through the prism of this report, we see renewed debate in some states like California about tuition increases, where there have been freezes and debates over whether certain kinds of tuition policies, whether increases do or don't help students. And then, to me, I was struck in the report by the impact that greater Pell Grant spending helps minimize what families are actually paying. And so I find myself wondering, in the current Congress, are we going to continue to boost Pell or not, and what impact that will have going ahead?
Let's focus on the Pell Grants for a moment. So the report indicates that there was a significant increase in Pell Grants during the economic downturn, rising from 30% of grants in academic year 2008 to 45% in 2011, and then falling to 40% in 2014. Sandy, what have we learned from this experience? And let me come back to the question that Scott asked. What are the prospects for Pell funding given the turn in Congress? We now have a Republican-dominated and incredibly cost-conscious Congress that will now look at budget and policy issues.
Well, one thing that we learned is that the federal government really can make a difference. Higher education, public higher education, is primarily funded by the states. But when the state budgets led to really difficult circumstances for students, the federal government did step up, and it did make a very big difference in the opportunities available to students. What will happen in the future? I'm not going to predict what this Congress will do, but my hope is that there will be attention to the structure of student aid programs, both at the federal level and the state level, and that we will be able to think about how to be sure that the dollars that we spend not only increase, but also are as effective as possible.
So, Scott, the Higher Education Act is up for reauthorization. It looks like it could be a complete rewrite as Lamar Alexander becomes head of the Senate committee that will be responsible for that. What's the experience, what's the knowledge that comes off of this report and other reports as higher ed goes into reauthorization? Pell Grants or Title IV money is an important part of that.
Well, I actually think if you look at this report and think about Pell Grants, you might not want to totally scrap Pell Grants and start from scratch because, as Sandy noted, Pell Grants actually helped students, helped a lot of families, and made a real difference in tough times. Now, there's always are lots of proposals about how to change Pell, and I think one of the tricky things for people who are working on this issue is the real impact on families of whether they can afford higher ed or not is from so many sources, from the policies of colleges, from the policies of states, from the availability of Pell, from the conditions on loans. And so a lot of people who are very concerned about college costs, I'm talking about real families, don't necessarily really know what the key point is that helped them or hurt them. So it's very hard to get a meaningful, broad public debate on these issues.
Sandy, I want to turn to the issue of state funding. We know that there's been a huge decline in terms of state funding on an FTE basis. The report that you issued says that FTE funding fell by 23% in constant dollars from academic year 2009 to 2014. Admittedly, that average number reflects variations across many states. Some cases the numbers were higher, some cases the numbers were lower. But the state role seems to have a play a critical role, obviously, and most students attend public institutions.
That's correct, and I think we have a real problem with the structure of funding higher education because of the dramatic variation across states. So on a national level, you know, we talk a lot about what happened to the average price or what is the average grant aid that students get, but the published tuition rates are almost three times as high in New Hampshire as they are in Utah and Wyoming. So, I mean, talking about what's going on in the nation is really difficult. I think that we need to take stock of the fact that there are really unequal opportunities available for students depending on where they live. And some states have generous need-based grant programs, others have none. So that is a really huge problem for us.
And Scott, as you track the landscape in the wake of the recent election and governors, some who were perceived to be friendly to higher ed and others who were perceived to be hostile, what do you see on the landscape in terms of future funding for by the states?
Well, I mean, I think something that unites some Democratic and Republican governors that they're very fond of tuition freezes. And tuition freezes sound good, they're politically popular, but I think there are real questions about tuition freezes that are not accompanied by state investments. And so some tuition freeze policies, if they result in sections being canceled and financial aid being less available, may not actually help students enroll and graduate. Other tuition freezes accompanied by the right other policies might be very beneficial. So I think the trick really for higher education, for good public policy, is to move beyond a view that just saying this is a tuition freeze, this is a tuition increase, is the be-all and end-all. It's a lot of things.
Sandy, let's turn to private colleges for a moment. The report indicates that at public institutions, tuition rose 10% over inflation over the past 5 years for undergraduate programs, while for private nonprofit colleges, undergraduate tuition rose 13%. What's happening here?
Well, first, let me just say in terms of the tuition increases that when we talk about tuition increases without talking about the net prices that students actually pay, we can really miss a lot of the story. Because it is possible, I mean, if a state has limited funds, I mean, I would like the states to put more money into higher education, but given the amount of money that they're putting into it, you can get a very different impact if you lower tuition for everyone, but low-income students still can't afford it, or if you raise tuition a little bit and make your need-based grant programs more generous, that could be more positive. So I always want to be cautious about that. At private colleges, it's a very big issue because, of course, private colleges discount dramatically. Frequently, private colleges raise their prices and no one ends up, you know, paying more because they discount more. So the pricing policies are so complicated and there's so much variation in what goes on across institutions that it's very difficult to generalize about what's going on at private colleges.
But let's go back to the states. I mean, Scott Jasek, the states have largely, not exclusively, and Sandy alluded to this, that there are some very high-cost states, but the states have largely had a low-tuition policy, assuming access for all, that represents, some would argue, a subsidy for upper-income students, and still a difficult, whereas even states with lower tuition policies, that can still be a reach for many low-income students. How does that going to play out? Will this sort of reframe some of the conversation that some states might switch to high-income, high-aid?
I think states have been moving away from the low tuition, low aid now for some time. And while you still have the wide variation among states depending on where they started, the truly low tuition, low aid model is not nearly as prevalent as it once was. The reality is many of the governors, many of the state legislators do not view higher education as a public good, do not view the right to be able to afford higher education as something that the state needs to prioritize as opposed to an individual. So while they may blast college costs, many of them are supporting policies that would require more borrowing.
All right, Sandy, let's turn to loans. This has been a very big topic, particularly once the soundbite was out, I believe last year, that student loan debt had exceeded consumer debt at over $1 trillion. So even as the reports indicate, as loans as a percentage of the undergraduate aid packages are declining, student debt, according to the report you issued, is now averages over $27,000 for academic 2000-year baccalaureate grads from public and private institutions, and that number is up 13% in 5 years. Also, the percentage of recent graduates with loan debt over $40,000 jumped from 2 to 18% from 2004 to 2012. Those are big numbers, and yet, you know, the numbers this year where loan as a percentage of the package is declining a little bit, is that the beginning of the trend, or is that just sort of a one-year data point?
Well, this is the third year in a row that annual borrowing per student has declined, but I have no predictions about what will happen next year. Let me just say that I think that this soundbite about credit card debt is pretty unfortunate. I mean, we need to be worried about a lot of problems with student debt. But comparing them to credit card debt, I mean, maybe students should just put college on their credit cards and then credit card debt would be higher and student debt would be lower and nobody would be better off. And credit card debt plummeted and people put the kinds of things people put on their credit cards are not generally investments. So I think that's not a good measure of student debt. I think that what's a good measure is how much debt different students leave school with and how that's increasing and whether they're going to be able to pay it back and what provisions we have to protect them. So students who leave school without a degree or certificate are the most at risk and the most likely to default on their loans. And that's a real problem. But the problem is not how many dollars they're borrowing. They might borrow $5,000, but then be working at the minimum wage. So high levels of debt and repayment problems are not necessarily the same. The increases in the debt with which bachelor's degree recipients graduate are a concern. If the annual borrowing continues to decline, then that should also decline. But most of those students are fine, but a growing portion are not likely to be fine. And we need to focus on what's going on with those students and try to do something about it.
Scott, how likely is loan debt to play in reauthorization? Is this a soundbite and perhaps an unfortunate one, as Sandy suggests, or is this one that will actually have some significant policy consequences as Congress comes back and begins to look at reauthorization and budget issues?
I'd say both is the answer to your question. I think the soundbite is very deceptive, because, and I think it's having a dangerous impact in that you hear a lot of reports from colleges about families saying, you know, I don't want to consider any debt. And modest borrowing with a plan to graduate on time and a sense of how that money is going to be repaid can be the best investment a young person or family can make. Borrowing a lot of money without a clear plan, delaying graduation, moving around among a bunch of institutions, well, that can be a recipe for the kind of debt that really has an impact on a person's options. So to talk about debt in a single assumption that it's the same for everyone, I think is really unfortunate.
Sandy, let's go back to the aggregate debt. There were some numbers coming out from several sources last week that disaggregated undergraduate and graduate debt. Graduate students are about 17% of enrollment, and yet there were several reports that the graduate student loan debt actually is about 40% of those dollars. Is that cause for concern?
We document in the trend report some of the details of graduate student debt, which has increased much more rapidly than undergraduate debt. If you look at people who get doctorate degrees in professional practice, so doctors and lawyers and practicing psychologists and so on, they have extraordinarily high levels of debt. Now, they also have much higher incomes than most people. So, I mean, we all know that some lawyers have a lot of trouble repaying their debt, but by and large, the policy question of how should we think about lawyers borrowing and how should we think about undergraduate students from low-income families that are trying to get, you know, some sort of a degree that will allow them to, you know, have a reasonable life, those are two different policy issues. So while I am worried about some of the graduate students, I think it's very important for people to understand that so much of this debt is for graduate study, and I think is, by and large, less of a concern than it would be if all of that debt were for undergraduate study.
So, Sandy and Scott, as we close, looking forward, we've got a new Congress, a highly budget-conscious Congress. Sandy and then Scott, what should we be looking at in terms of the landscape for student aid over the next year or two?
Well, I think it's going to be, first, I mean, I know people are nervous about protecting the student aid programs, and I think we need to be nervous about that and make sure that we do our best to protect them. But I also am optimistic that there will be attention to simplifying the student aid system and to making it actually more effective in meeting its goals, because we need money, but we need more than money.
Scott?
And along those lines, I'd say it'll be very interesting to watch. Are the reforms designed to really make the aid programs more effective, or are they designed to save money? Not to say that you can't do both at the same time, but what will be the underlying push? And I think that'll have a lot to do with what the result is.
Sandy Baum, Senior Fellow at the Urban Institute and author of the College Trends Report, Scott Jasek, thank you. Interesting, informative, and something to think about as, again, Congress comes back and higher ed reauthorization moves forward. In our second segment today, we're going to talk about internships for all. Internships have become an increasingly important part of the undergraduate experience for those concerned about connecting college to the world of work. For many years, most institutions were passive conduits for internships, posting internship opportunities on the walls and the websites of campus career centers, even as student interest and demand grew dramatically in commercial services such as internships.com, InternMatch, and summer internships, and others emerged to assist students looking for internships and employers looking for interns. This week, Brown University joined a small but growing number of colleges and universities that are making an institutional commitment to assist undergraduates with internships and related research opportunities. Like many other institutions, Brown is reaching out to alumni who can provide internship and research opportunities for its students. But what differentiates the Brown Initiative from others is that the university will help with stipends for students who take low-paying or unpaid internships, an effort that university officials feel is essential in removing a major barrier to some internship opportunities for Brown students who receive need-based financial aid. Joining us for this conversation are Christina Paxson, president of Brown University, Gregory Waite, who is the president of the Washington Internship Institute, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Christina Paxson at Brown University, let me begin with you. The Brown Initiative clearly seems different than others in terms of trying to expand the experiential opportunities for students. Tell us about the history and what Brown is doing differently, if you would, please.
So Brown just yesterday launched a new program called Brown Connect. And it has a number of components, several of which you mentioned. One is to provide students with much more information about internship opportunities. The second is to actually proactively create those opportunities for our students through engagement with alumni and parents and friends of Brown. And the third that I think is essential is to create access for students who may not be able to take these opportunities because of their family income levels. I think of this as the next step in financial aid.
Let me talk about that for a moment. So I looked at the Brown website this morning. 43% of your undergraduate population gets aid that averages about $40,000. And for the students who entered this fall, who are part of the class of 2018, that number is 48% who are getting need-based aid, and that aid averages about $44,000. That's a large number of students, and again, if they all take internships and need stipends, or some number do, that's a significant amount of dollars. How is that going in terms of supporting that initiative?
Well, that's a very good question, and we have rolled this out because we've made some early success in fundraising, and now that it's public and we're really broadcasting it, we will have much more success. I'm confident of that. The response that we've received so far from alumni and parents has been incredible. One thing that I think is important to note, though, is that not all internships require financial support. And we don't really know how much this is going to cost yet, because the more successful we are at identifying high-quality, high-paying summer internships, the less financial support we'll have to provide to our students.
Great. Gregory Wright at the Washington Internship Institute. Internships seem to be now part of almost a requirement for many students as part of a larger portfolio. Yet internships, co-op programs, and student research programs have been part of the college landscape for decades. Why all of a sudden, or suddenly, you know, over the last 5 years, more focus on internships, more focus on these kind of experiential things that complement and supplement the coursework and the campus experience?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the economic landscape. You have the economic downturn, and so students graduating from colleges and universities want to make sure that they have the proper preparation for finding a job in this difficult job market. I think it also points to sort of a related point about the increasing accountability for colleges and universities across the board, that they're providing an education for students that is rigorous, yet also produces, you know, possibilities for them to find gainful employment after they graduate. So I think there's a twofold reason for it. I also think that students are seeking to get credentialed in more ways than previously, perhaps, again, probably because of these economic pressures. I find when I go to colleges, to our partner institutions, more and more students are double and triple majoring as a way of sort of demonstrating on their resume that they are prepared for the working world. I don't necessarily agree with that need, but I think that internships are, again, a way for them to go out into the workforce and say, I have experience and I'm ready to hit the ground running.
But to Christina Paxson's point about financial aid issues and the barrier that internship opportunities may present for some students if they are unpaid or lowly paid, how big of an issue is that? You see students from all kinds of campuses and at all income levels at the Institute and other work that you've done.
Right. Yeah, I think it is an issue. Our program offers opportunities for students during the semester to come to D.C. For almost a full-time internship. And those are the programs during the fall and the semester where we often will see students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds because their financial aid will often travel from their home institution. The summer program is more difficult for those students, and I think summer internships is where we see problems with that. And so I think more support from at the institutional level and also from internship providers is important.
Scott, for some of us who are a little older, we remember that AP exams were once the anomaly. They weren't almost a de facto requirement. I'm wondering, you know, in fact, given the labor market issues, the competitiveness that Greg talked about, you know, are internships becoming a de facto requirement the way that AP exams are for students who apply to selective colleges and postdocs are for many folks in the sciences who have to do several years before they go into academic employment?
I certainly think that a lot of students want to have a resume that has employment off of, in some form, off the campus and hopefully related to their career. So I think it is increasingly a requirement. Now, you need to be careful about that because people are using internships to apply for second internships, and you need somehow to let people have their first experiences as well. But in the current economy, people are trying to bolster their skills, and let's face it, not every undergraduate knows what he or she wants to do. An internship also has real value in exposing somebody to a possible career, and they may or may not like it.
Let's talk about unpaid internships. The Department of Labor has ruled that students who take unpaid internships in not-for-profit organizations, that doesn't pose a problem. But for those who work in for-profit organizations, the internship has to be for the benefit of the student, not the employer. This is an issue that's moving through the courts in terms of experiences that students in several sectors have had. Do universities and colleges have a responsibility to do some vetting here? Christina Paxson, how is Brown dealing with this issue?
Well, we are keeping a very close eye on this issue, and it's becoming very clear to us that more and more internships that previously would have been unpaid are now, you know, the employers are realizing, especially California employees are kind of at the vanguard of this, that they do have to pay students. I think that's terrific. And again, you know, the more students we can have who are receiving paid summer internships, the better. One big area that we're interested in is developing international internships. And there the rules are very, very different. And that's another whole area that universities are having to figure out in a complicated environment.
Gregory, wait, let me turn to you in terms of the issue of unpaid internships. There's lots of them in Washington where you are, but again, these would primarily be with nonprofit organizations. But again, drawing on your experience at the Institute and other things that you've done over your career, should career centers take some role in terms of vetting unpaid internships to be sure that they really do provide an experiential opportunity that benefits the student rather than the employer?
Well, absolutely. I think it's important in any internship, unpaid or paid, that there are clear learning goals established for the student, that the employer in this case is aware of what their responsibilities are to fulfill those learning goals, that there are constant sort of interactions between the student and the employer as well as the institution about the student's progress on those goals. This is still a learning opportunity. This is not just career practicum. This is integrated into the student's academic experience, and it's important that it's treated as such. And I think, you know, with the proper vetting of internships with close evaluations by students afterwards so that students, future students, know what good internships are at good organizations, I think you can ensure that.
Scott Jasek, not all internships are created equal or have equal value. There's a long history, for example, in engineering firms, in some technology firms, in accounting firms, of the internship as being both a viable experience as well as a gateway to employment. That's not always the case in other contexts. And also, there's some evidence, or at least there's some data, it may not be great evidence, from a recent Gallup poll about the impact of internships. Talk with us a little bit about the Gallup finding and how that relates to this conversation.
Well, the Gallup finding showed that it's a minority of those with internships that felt that they truly related to both their academic interests and advancing their careers. And that's consistent with other findings. I mean, there's been a lot of scrutiny because of the legal issues you mentioned of whether internships should be paid. I think there's probably not enough scrutiny of sort of, are internships really internships? You know, being here in Washington, there are a lot of places that are, that I won't name, where interns do spend too much time getting their boss's dry cleaning or whatever. Internships need to be not just sort of personal assistance to someone in an organization. And so the ones that are going to be valuable are where a person has some substantive work, has some mentoring, has some coherence between that and their goals. And that doesn't just happen by accident. It requires a commitment by all involved.
Christina Paxson of Brown, let me turn to you as a president. We've seen, not just in the context of internships, but some other areas, Ohio State made a major initiative at some point a few years ago about study abroad experience, and Gordon Gee, during his second term as president there, seemed to take great pride in some exponential increase in the number of undergraduates who had passports. More statements by presidents, not just about the value of the campus experience, but also the campus connecting with a larger world. Can we expect to see more of this from you and your presidential counterparts?
That's a very good question, and I think the answer is yes. And this is part of just a broad change in the higher education landscape. It ties in with some of the work that we're doing in online learning and flipped classrooms, a change in philosophy where a lot of the, informational content can be obtained, of courses can be obtained in other ways, but we're realizing the value of students working together, working off campus, working around the world, but staying connected back to the campus virtually. So I think it's actually a very exciting time where we can expand what we call engaged learning. I think we know from experience that these experiences off campus are not just about preparing for careers. They're part of learning, as Gregory pointed out. And, you know, students are developing skills. They're bringing these back into the classroom. They're taking them back out the next summer. And if you do it right, it's all part of a really fantastic educational experience.
Gregory, wait, what about competition for internships? If demand is rising, does this now mean that the internships are going to be more difficult for many students, highly valued ones in Washington or in various firms?
I think so, but I also think that there's still a great supply out there. And I think, you know, we're working with organizations all the time to introduce them to the possibility of hosting students when maybe they hadn't thought that students would really fit into their organizational structure or their needs. I think that on the employer side, you've seen a shift also to see that they see that students can do a lot more than they thought they could. And so I think that they're continuing to value internships and the things that interns can bring to their organizations a lot more.
And Scott, as you survey the landscape, you know, whether it's the study abroad, it's the internship experience or other issues, what about the ability of students to just sort of visualize and what this means about student portfolios as we go forward?
Well, that I think it's the students' ability to visualize, but also very practically to pay for it. What I think is significant about what Brown is doing is they're not just saying, hey, internships are a good thing. They're saying internships are a good thing, and we're going to help the low-income student do that. If you look at who traditionally has done study abroad, it has not been a cross-section of America. It has been the economically elite. And you have both financial issues, but you also have a sense of, is study abroad something that I grew up hearing about other people doing? Do I have a passport? Does everyone in my family have a passport? And I think to apply the Brown idea of saying, if we think this matters, we're going to make it possible for everyone and help them. I think if that idea spreads, we could see impact far beyond the issue of internships alone.
That's great. But Christina Paxson at Brown University, Gregory Waite at the Washington Internship Institute, and Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, thank you for your time this morning. Two, we want to thank Sandy Baum at the Urban Institute, George Washington University, and the co-author of the College Board Reports on College Costs and Financial Aid for joining us. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoons on most Fridays. On the web, we're available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.